Well, hello everyone. I'm joined yet again by Alex Masters. Now, I was a little bit surprised, I have to say, when he suggested this, because he wanted to speak in defense of Anglo-futurism. I don't know if you happened to catch the conversation I had with Blamblas. I think the video was called "Is Traditionalism a Useless LARP?" He was a controversial guest. Let's say he split the crowd, politely. But during the scope of that conversation, I voiced my skepticism for Anglo-futurism. And I'll just lay out the problem I see. I mean, Jendrick, this figure who's just joined Reform, has gone on record to say that he is an Anglo-futurist. And when I look at the memes and things that are put out, I just see it basically as Toryism, as the Conservative Party's, like what they're doing already, Tom Harwood, right, with vaguely traditionalist or Shire aesthetics painted on top of it, or as I put it before, trumped them with Zeppelins, something like this, right?
Yeah.
This makes me like skeptical as to what it is and what the people who push Anglo-futurism are up to. So during this conversation, I'm gonna give you the floor in a second. But if you're trying to sell me kind of warmed up Boris Johnson policies in a tweed coat, I'll just say, "Oi, Masters, no, I'll say. I know what you're up to. You can't pull the wool over my eyes." But anyway, before we get going, I'll remind everyone. Promo code SHORJANG gets you 25% of all courses currently. Alex, where can people find you?
Yep. So you can find me on Twitter, A2_masters, or just search Alex That Steam Guy for the latest updates.
So, right, in defense of Anglo-futurism, and I promise I will mute myself and let you talk for at least 2 minutes before I come in, okay?
I think there's no muting needed. Yes, I thought this would be a bit of a clickbaity headline. In all honesty, I think moving on from our discussion earlier about where the online right finds itself and its lack of direction, Anglo-futurism really popped up about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, by some people who I actually quite like. I think a lot of people try and paint it with the political brush. We're so used to looking at things through a political lens, we assume this is the same. It's not. It's an expressly apolitical thing, which is why it ends up, you know, with sort of reheated Toryism in places, and there's a bit of New Labour, and there's a bit of, you know, all sorts of this. My defence of Anglo-futurism is that I think that positive vision requirement is obviously correct. I like its basis in technology. I have skepticism about its AI posting, and you know, red squirrels in space suits. I find it quite charming, the idea of Georgian townhouses on the moon and small modular reactors under the village cricket green. But this is the kind of thing that we need. We need a positive vision. So we said, you know, in our first conversation that ultimately the right has boiled its position down to clear them out. And you say, right, okay, we have cleared them out. Now what? And I think Anglo-futurism, even as it stands today, is probably the closest thing to our spheres of what the so what would be. I don't think it's there yet. I've had a number of back and forths with members in it where you sort of go, yes, but isn't this just, you know, reheated liberalism and we'll end up in the same place in 50 years' time? You can get accused of being sort of a bit of a pessimist and a doom, and this is an optimistic movement, and we don't want the optimism to be lost, to which, of course, you have to respond, optimism is cowardice. But it was simply to say, they've got an idea for what the future looks like. And yes, it's nice architecture, high-speed rail, small modular reactors. I'm okay with that. I like the idea of raising Doggerland. I don't think it's a serious proposal, but I like it because it's a big thing. And I think when we move to the final part of our conversation, we're going to reflect somewhat on how our sort of the country's ambitions have become very, very small. It's not working towards any great project. And some great project like that, no matter how far forwards it may ever go, it is something good. I think as well with the Anglo-Futurists, they think that we can turn this around just by turning a few knobs on the dials. Me and a number of other engineers are sort of sat there going, no, I don't think you've hauled in just how bad the situation is. We're going to have to go down a lot further before we can come back. So it's that really. It's just trying the unrelenting slot posting and pessimism and as we said in our first conversation, how little the right has actually concrete managed to achieve in the last 10 years. At least having, you know, something a little bit more lighthearted, I think is good for the spirit, because yeah, it can become pretty toxic. And very samey in these circles every now and again.
Come on, Alex the Steam guy is trying to sell me on HS2, the third runway at Heathrow, and building a bloody blade server farm in Abingdon. That's what you're talking about. This is at the end of the day, that's what you're talking about, which is like literally exactly what Tony Blair would do.
Yeah, but he'd use it for the liberal panopticon, whereas I would use it for base purposes.
HS2 and the base third. The base, runway,
yes, this would be the BBR, the base British Rail. And you
that's
know,
it. The conversation's over, Alex. That's it.
I think it moves more into a. That's why I said it was a bit of a clickbaity headline. It was. I want to talk about what does the sensible centre, what does the online right actually want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are its victory conditions, and where does it go from there? And if the content on substance has been very light, the content on the direction has been even lighter. If we've been spending 10 years, you know, becoming quite theory sell about sort of things. Okay, now the next 10 years needs to be, but where is it going? And I don't think we're having those conversations yet. And Anglo-Futurism, for all its faults, is a starter for 10 on where this all goes.
I mean, to speak seriously for a second, I think the current Labour government, for all their faults and all their ills, and yeah, we talked about everybody knows what Starmer is and why everybody hates him, etc. But they are thinking seriously. I mean, I heard a conversation from, I think it was the Labour Transport Secretary, who said, like, look, the rail links in the southeast are good, right? But up in the northwest of the country, you know, a journey from Liverpool to Manchester takes about 2.5 hours, which is unacceptable. Whereas the same journey from Reading to London takes half an hour or 40 minutes or something like that. So, I mean, they are having, like, these conversations are being done, like, are being had by the current government.
Hmm.
And, I mean, in theory, your Anglo-Futurist should be like, yeah, this is good. We support Labour in this, but I don't really see much of that sort of talk. It's too boring.
Yeah.
It's too,
like... There's the other ones of those, and they had a big event and then went quiet with a Looking for Growth, if you remember them. And they were actually sort of ex-New Labour staffers.
Right.
Who were in sort of a very similar vein to that, but again, it comes back to your point that the sensible discussions are increasingly being had on the left,
mm-hmm.
and this is a big problem for the right, because you know Aaron Bastani is actually probably one of the best Twitter posters out there, because he is actually, you know, I may not agree entirely with his solutions, but his identifications of the problems are correct. His identification of the systems that have brought about those problems is largely correct.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he discounts immigration as an internal factor, and you can have the argument with him there. And his ambitions as well, his vision for, he put up a post a couple of days ago, and it was a very short post. It was like, it was about all the Green Lantern stuff. And he went, look, I just want the government to do this. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially, you know, build houses, fix the potholes, make sure the health system works reasonably well, make sure the trains run on time, and don't take the piss on the regulation side.
The way he actually put it, I remember that tweet, the way Bastani put it is restore the Victorian town centre. That's the way he put it. So he even dressed it in trad aesthetics, if you want, or something that might appeal to normal British people. One of the things that Bastani is very focused on, and the left increasingly have been focused on, and again, this is, I don't know why conversations don't happen more like this on the quote-unquote right, is the issue of Britain as a sovereign nation, the issue of the government having independence from America specifically. There was that book, Vassal State, that was written. Bastani had him on, generated a lot of conversation on the left, almost no conversation on the right. Hmm. Partly because people feel beholden to cheerlead Trump or see Trump as their guy or see Trump, they've got some loyalty to him or something like this. And so they end up in this strange space where they're actually, I mean, the worst example was that Daily Mail headline from the other day, Richard Littlejohn, who was basically saying, you know, forget about Greenland. I want Trump to take over here. Can't be worse. Mm. Like literally cheering on the theoretical American invasion of Britain and a formal takeover. I've seen Carl make posts along these lines. This was a kind of take that several of the Lotus Eaters had a couple of weeks back. They'll say they were joking and so on, but you know, it was when they were talking about regime change. I think in Iran, they were like, well, we need regime change here. Okay, ha-ha. But the point is that the actual patriotic position, the real one, the one that Enoch Powell would have recognized, is currently being owned by Navarra Media.
Yeah.
Which is like a far-left organization. And Bastani. I mean, to me, this is like bizarre. And it's like, well, okay, at a certain point you think, well, do you just give up on rightists? Can they ever stop being slop-brained long enough to actually recognize, oh, well, these are actually really important things we're talking about. And if we want to have a functioning country, we need to be thinking along these lines. Or do you just say, well, we're going to have to write them off and try to start working with sensible leftists?
Yeah.
Serious.
Yeah, and this is the big thing. I remember saying to Radlib years ago, I think it was at the Witan he turned up to, which was the second one, I think. So, that you know, we've now had five of those. This is a long time. I said, you know, no meaningful progress will be made on the British right until we regard the Americans as foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
The British right needs desperately to treat American politics like it treats German politics. You know, it's a difficult pub quiz answer, and it might be interesting from a third party perspective, but ultimately the internal affairs of America, and Minnesota is an absolutely prime example of this. Minnesota is an internal domestic pub matter to a foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter to us, and you posting about it all the time, not UAA, I mean the collective you listeners, dear listeners, is wasting your time. And again, it comes back to the time aspect. It's always time. Time is the one quantity you can never inflate and you can never get back. Once it's gone, it's gone. So you must treat every second, every single thing you're doing must be conserved, and it must be precious, and it must be advantageous to the ultimate objective of what you're doing. And if you are sat there laughing at a foreigner shooting a foreigner for running them over with a car in a foreign country, you are not progressing the sensible British centre forwards.
Yeah, I mean, I do my best to try to only comment on American politics as it pertains to foreign policy, or as it pertains to, because I guess the difference between America and Germany is that they are the hegemon, right?
Yeah.
And the president, whatever the president of America does matter, right? It does matter, and it has an impact. As obviously, currently, the Greenland situation is having a huge impact on European security and on how we think about, you know, Britain as a sovereign nation or as a vassal, etc. These things are important, but I'm inclined to agree that the internal affairs. I mean, one of the stories I always sit out are things like shootings, you know, domestic tragedies. Like, to me, this is like, you know, like a local crime story or something. You just don't, it's not, it's just yeah. outside of our sphere of having to care about, if that makes any sense. Like, you know, yeah. somebody was shot in Chicago or something. I mean, that probably happens every day. You know what I mean? Yeah. Other than there are certain kind of huge events, like, I guess, like the Charlie Kirk shooting, that had, I guess, greater symbolic value because he was a well-known media figure, a political figure. It was a political assassination. But even there, I think some people took it way too far. I mean, do you remember there was that Charlie Kirk pub opened in London?
Yeah.
Do you remember that happened? I mean, it's like, come on now, you know. There's also a limit even to that sort of stuff. Interesting. Okay, so we've drifted a little bit from Anglo-futurism. I'm still not seeing, Alex, how it's that far different from supporting those things that the government are already doing or that has already had investment put towards it.
Yeah.
Or even worse. You know, every once in a while, Tom Harwood of GB News fame will, you know, he'll post some lovely images of some green rolling field, and he'll be like, "How comes we haven't put a massive multi-story car park on that then? Why isn't this all being turned into housing?" To which I always have a kind of revulsion response. I don't want to destroy the green rolling fields like Tom Harwood.
Yeah.
He's a filthy libertarian.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think... And it is one of the discussion points that I have had with them in the past is this is still seemingly built on the infinite growth model.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still sort of going, there's still slack in the system. You can just infinitely grow. And yeah, all these, you know, lovely new model villages and all the rest of it. But no matter how lovely the aesthetic is and how, you know, how beautifully you've done the townhouses in the central square, and actually it bonds with the Aaron Bastani vision of, you know, the Victorian high street and all the rest of it. Yes, but to do that, there needs to be the demand for housing, and the only reason, the way the demand for housing comes, is through immigration. We've had a sub replacement birth rate since 1972. The absolute population of British people in Britain peaked in about 2004, I think. Yeah. We are living in a time of a declining population. The only reason we're not is because it's being artificially inflated through immigration. So it's one of the blind spots, and this is where politics really isn't helpful. And actually, you need to depoliticize your thinking, because yeah, you, me, Aaron Bastani, you know, the Labour government, the Tories, everybody essentially wants the nice things.
Mm-hmm.
But there, each one of us has a sort of strategic blind spot, which is then what differentiates our political analysis. And the big one for a lot of mainstream people is immigration and population levels, because particularly sat here in the countryside, one of the hallmarks of the countryside is it's very sparsely populated. And if you keep importing people, or if you keep having these grand schemes for garden cities and new model villages and all this industrial development, that has to be built somewhere. We're an overpopulated island as it is. That means that you're going to be building on the countryside, which means there's less of it, which is a bad thing. One of my stock responses to people is I dream of an England of 30 millions, because and all that was a back of fag packet sum where I looked at the population density of Devon, which, mm-hmm. you know, you've got Plymouth and Exeter, you've got two big cities, but it's also mostly open space and sort of agricultural land. You put the population density of Devon over the land area of the British Isles, and it pops out at about 32.5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them have got that model, which is actually an opportunity for people in our spheres to say, right, the the strategic weakness of all these things, Anglo-futurism included, is that they are based on an infinite growth model. We're going to be moving, regardless of what people might wish, to a time of falling population, which then means the housing issue goes away, but it also means you've got excess housing, which actually probably means in about 30 years' time, we'll be wondering about what to do with all the dead stock and how we're going to again, it's a horrible word on the right, but rewilding, you know, because they go, oh, that means Bill Gates. No, if you're going to have housing estates that aren't full, you're going to have to put them back to agricultural land. And how do you do that? That's a policy challenge. So you need the policy there, but it's not a political issue. You know, the welfare issue does not go away. And this is another one is sort of it's not only that you're going to be deporting 38% of the nation's children, but the welfare issue doesn't go away. So how are you going to, you know, are you just going to abolish the welfare state? That's a separate argument entirely. Are you going to go for productivity boosting? Okay, so productivity boosting is the one everybody wants, but we're overregulated and we're massively overleveraged, and we've got a competency crisis, and we've got these things. So it's the challenge I'm putting forward to the Anglo-futurists, to the right generally, to all political factions, actually, is we have these structural issues. Your politics is making you strategically blind to at least one of them. But all that means is that your vision is doomed because you've not done a complete analysis on it. It's almost like trying to build a bridge without thinking about the weight of the vehicles on it.
See, again, housing is a pretty good example of part of the issue that I'm talking about with the covert libertarianism, right? Because, okay, you could say, well, yes, immigration exacerbates the problem because it increases demand. But actually, the root of the problem is twofold. One of the reasons we have all these massive housing projects is because the construction industry is one of the huge lobby donors to both the political parties. They were the biggest backers of Boris Johnson, who launched all these things. Well, of course, it's a massive payday. You have a look. I mean, round here, I mean, there was massive local... near RHS Wisley, you know, they've got that lovely kind of flower gardens and stuff down there. They've built this new town, New Wisley. Okay, and I've been stuck in traffic driving here for the past 2 years because they have to realter all the roads and things to accommodate this new town. But if you take a drive that way into Middlesex, okay, and I take my daughter to this little farm place, like a kind of adventure play farm thing, it's like a theme park. I noticed tons of houses are up for sale because they're building these villages, these new villages everywhere. But then you have a look at, like, what are these villages? And it's not, I mean, they call it it's sold by Angela Rayner or whoever, Boris, as affordable housing. But then you actually have a look at what they're doing, and it's being sold as luxury housing. And the prices aren't actually particularly lower than the local prices around here, you're talking upwards of north of $500,000, over $1 million for a proper house, you know, up to $2 million, etc. So it's not particularly affordable. It's not actually solving the issue. The problem I have with the housing, and sorry to digress on this, if you take your typical so in econ, you've got your price, and then you've got your supply and demand. Well, the problem in housing is that the demand curve is like that. It's vertical like that. Why is it vertical? That's your demand, and then the supply, whatever it is something like that. Okay, there's your supply, there's your S, and there's your D. Why is the demand curve completely vertical in that way, or close to vertical? It's because anybody anywhere in the world can bid on a house in Britain. You can build it, you can buy a house, you can, I mean, at one point, half of London was bought by Russians. If you go down to the posh areas of London now, you know, they're all this like Saudis and sheikhs and so on. Half of those houses are empty, but they're owned by like multi-billionaires. There's nothing stopping massive corporations or massive, just anyone wealthy, Chinese, whoever, can just come up and buy land, buy housing stock. So the first thing I would do, again, you can call me a socialist, is just say, look, no foreigners can buy houses at all, period. I know there's some like rules you have to live there 6 months a year and stuff. I just say, look, no, all housing has to be for British citizens. And that would help dent. That would help make that demand curve less vertical. It would help to kind of bring it that way, which should bring the price down. The point is, the system doesn't want to bring the price down. I'm a homeowner myself. Once you've got a house, you don't want it to go down. So the incentive of the system is always to drive it up. And what better way to keep it always going up to say, oh, we're going to open up this house listing in Hong Kong. And there's been lots of examples of housing being opened up, and they actually open it up to foreign markets first. So they actually get first dibs. So to me, it's not even just about immigration. It's about the whole construction industry and about the housing market and about the international housing market. But again, because all of these people are secret libertarians or IEA alumni or whatever, they don't want to touch anything that I talked about there, because that's getting too close to actually dealing with a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's as I come back to it, you know, your politics is essentially you declaring your analytical blind spots, and it becomes really, really tiresome. I think that's again where the sort of sensible centre come. I think it's why libertarianism died. Actually, was you ask exactly that question and say, well, I believe that the economy should do this, 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 and this, and you go, yeah, but what if some Russian oligarch just comes and buys it all? And they go, well, that's fine. And you go, oh, right, so that was a useless political medium. Mm-hmm. What defences have you got for me as a, you know, downtrodden wagee against a Chinese billionaire? Oh, none, it's free and open competition. Well, bollocks to that. No, I'm not interested in that. And you're quite right that it's the challenge I put to the sort of Anglo-futurists is... Yeah, the world you want to look at is lovely, and I support your ambition in building, you know, good housing stock that's nice to look at and emphasizing localism, but then also underpinning it with, you know, excellent technological solutions. That's a perfectly reasonable political ambition. I think it's one that we should, you know, adopt and push forwards. Actually, but you can't just then go, oh, yeah, but I don't expect the government to do any of this because that would be socialism. That's mean. Or again, it's like you have to be exclusionary of foreigners because that's what the racist right does. It's like, no, that's not. There's a top layer of just this is what government does. And the right has always been extremely, I don't even know if it's the right, but that libertarian section has always been extremely squeamish about forcing people to not do bad things. And yeah, that dream of a pleasant England of cricket greens, well, that means that that implies an upper limit on the population, which at some point means you have to talk about immigration controls. And I know it's yucky, and I know it means being mean to foreigners, but it has to be done. There's no other way to do it. And it's a similar thing on the developmental side. Okay, so you want to talk about high technology, and this is again a sort of blind spot of the government. We're coming up against the competency crisis now, where the half dozen high skilled boomers who actually have the ability to do the high techie stuff never trained anybody to come up beneath them because they saw them as a threat to their jobs, and they're all now in their mid 60s, so they're now going to retire. So where does that leave your ability to do that? It then becomes a bit of an exercise in the iron law of the golden toilet seat, where you can say anything you want. You know, absolutely, you can have that. But the how are you going to do it? Give me a credible plan. And that's where I want to be talking about. I want to be talking about the credible plans. I want to take a cross section of the resourceability of the online political right, and I want to match that against a set of policy proposals, which then generates realistic outcomes. Any talk beyond the capability restrictions of the group, it doesn't matter if it's the country or the voter base or the industry or anything like that, you wrap it around, that has got a resource component and a capability component, and your policy outcomes have to match the resources you have to hand. Otherwise, you're just talking pub bollocks.
I mean, what I would like to see, I mean, obviously immigration controls is a no-brainer, but I mean, I've said, in the EU, they talk about the four freedoms. To me, you have to have some degree of capital controls as well. Okay. If you don't hold at least two of those things constant, you just don't have a country.
Yeah.
And one of the issues, and again, this is a kind of wider structural issue, is that whether it's Starmer's government or the Tory government, at the minute, they're absolutely beholden to worrying about whether there's going to be a problem in the bond market or gilts or whatever, that any little adjustment you make is going to upset the markets, and therefore we can't do anything. But this issue that we're talking about requires some capital controls. It requires saying who can and can't, right, buy property in this case. But I would also want to put some sort of ring fence around to say, well, like let's say you're some like wealthy individual, and you know what's meant to happen is that you reallocate your resources to more productive ends. But what that's not been happening.
No.
The resources are reallocated to more productive ends halfway across the world. Well, that's no good to us. It's not good. That's not good to Britain, right? It could be. It might be good for that wealthy guy, but it's not good for us because it means that we have reduced capacity to do stuff because everything's abroad or it's too expensive to do here or something. It's that whole way of thinking on this growth model that's almost kind of like it holds the country captive because everything's financialized and everything's the markets. But it means like the government can't do anything, can't do any of this stuff.
I think this foreshadows the future of our conversation. It comes back to single element analysis. And unfortunately, I'm going to sort of blow my own trumpet. I put up a tweet a couple of weeks ago saying actually engineers are the superior beings. It's not arrogance, we're just better than you. Because an engineer is trained to look at a problem from dozens of different ways in dozens of different methods simultaneously. And political analysis, they are not trained to do that. So the reason they financialized everything is because they are looking at things from a purely financial way. But of course, you can manipulate the money markets and you can manipulate the bond market and you can manipulate the value of capital and you can believe, the monetary value of an object is subjective. So what you're doing is essentially trying to analyze a complex system through one data stream that's duff anyway. And that's what leads to all the perverse outcomes. You're quite right. One of the things I want to, it's one of the telling things in like the budget where they sort of go, well, homeowners are going to get this, but drivers are going to get this, but single mothers are going to get this, but business owners are going to get this. But and you go, they're literally treating them as different people. It's like, no, that's one guy. And it would be very interesting, completely going back on what I've just said, but for somebody to go, right, the average schmo has got on the national average wage. If you put then in all the average costs that he's expected to bear, so the average, an average mortgage, an average fuel bill, an average energy bill, an average food bill, all this, how much money has he got left on at the end of the month to actually just invest in as disposable income and investment, of course, because disposable income is then what he's prepared to put at risk in an investment portfolio or in developing new opportunities and things like that. I would take a bet that the average guy is probably like net down each month. And you see that, we've got a service-based economy. Now, the entire service-based economy, particularly leisure, retail, hospitality, with very few exceptions, you have to buy shoes. but that is all based on discretionary income. And if the discretionary income is actually negative in most cases, the like 60% of your economy becomes unviable.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would like to see, Alex, is a prime minister who's willing to just stand up to the city for a while, and say, like, look, okay, you can have a flap, but this is what is happening. Because if there is certainty and strength, the markets will readjust, right? And if you, but it requires a leader who's strong enough to say, like, look, I know what's going to come, but we've done it before and we can do it again, because this is the vision that we want to adopt. And, you know, this is best for our nation in the long run. So you market guys can do what you want. We're going to stand firm, rather than what has been in recent times, where, I mean, Liz Truss was brought down in theory by the city, and Boris and Starmer constantly U-turning all the time, announcing stuff and then going back on it. But actually that creates uncertainty. That creates an environment where you don't know what's happening and people don't want to invest then in an uncertain environment. If you just said, look, we are adopting this course, it's going to be like this for the next 20 years, people can plan for that.
Yeah.
People can say, okay, we know that's going to happen. Okay, we may pull some money out and it may affect gilts or whatever in the short term, but in the long run, you know what's happening. And other countries do that. Other countries are confident enough to make those sorts of moves, but not us for some reason.
So. Yeah, I've said to people in the past, if I ever became prime minister, my chancellor would issue one budget at the start, and they would say, right, we're in a 5-year parliament, this is the budget. And it would say, right, over the next 5 years, I'm going to taper off these taxes, and I'm going to taper off these benefits, and I'm going to increase this, and I'm going to keep everything proportionally the same. You know, so you say, right, health and social care budget is £350 billion a year or whatever. It will be that for the next 5 years. And when they scream blue murder at you, you go, right, with £3 trillion in the hole, what else do you propose I do about it? You know, and there's things, there's so much, we almost feel like a computer that's not been defragged for a long time. I was listening, because I always listen to the budget, because it's quite interesting from a, you know, policy wonk perspective. But there's like these, she spends most of the budget talking about these tiny, tiny little, tiny inconsequential taxes and tiny inconsequential benefits. And it's like these tiny little things. I don't think she even mentioned defence, or she just goes, yeah, they get £80 billion and left it at that. And it's, you go on, you know, the Treasury website and say, how many taxes are there in this country? And it goes, about 100. It's like, I'm sorry, the tax man, about. So you don't actually know how many taxes there are. And then you go, right, okay, so what's each tax bringing in? And some of them are a minus number. It's like, right, they're actually like de facto subsidies, because it always gets repaid. And then you go, right, okay, so there's things like, you know, lighthouse duty that have been there for centuries, they just never got rid of them. But there must be a department in the Treasury somewhere. You're paying for somebody to monitor the, and then of course you get into like income taxes and you lay it out in columns and you take from this column and then you add to that column and then you get rid of it from that column and you just sort of think. Another thing I do is go, right, there's about 100 taxes in the country. I'm just going to scrap the bottom 5 each year for 5 years. And I'm just going to scrap them. I'm not going to replace them with anything. I'm just going to get rid of them. And the guys in the Treasury are going to get reallocated to actually doing important work. You know, it's things like airport duty tariffs and the price. It's treated as a separate tax. It's like, why isn't it just VAT? And fuel duty.
If Rachel Reeves was sitting here, though, she'd say, well, you can't do that because, you know, the left will chimp, or, you know, we'd have a political crisis on our hands, or there'd be riots in the streets, or whatever. There'll be a reason why they can't do it. So,
yeah.
Play around the margins.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to this sort of, you know, we've got to depoliticize it a bit. It's, you know, the game seems to be now is you just take money from everybody, but then you only give it back to your friends. in many ways. And what it's led to is this unbelievably complicated Kafkaesque system of like giving and taking and shimmying, and the amount of Sir Humphreys who earn very nice money indeed. You know, people go on about taking on the civil service, but this is what it means, is sort of going, right, your department, I am scrapping that function of government. And they talk about this. They talk about functions and competencies within government, and what they mean is stuff the government does. And you literally have to make a big list of them and go, right, I am scrapping these ones. And they are not replacing, they're not being replaced by anything. I am removing, you know, I will introduce a one-piece bill into Parliament which says I am scrapping the following acts, and I'm clipping the wings of the Foreign Office or whatever it is, and I'm doing this. And you're free to put your civil servants back into the pool to, you know, to go into understaffed teams and all the rest of it. This whole I'm going to arbitrarily scrap 100,000 civil servants is bunk. It really, really annoys me when people do that. Again, it's people not doing the hard yards. You know, the civil service is as big as it is because it manages the legal requirements as the government has laid them out. So it's a big checkbox, and, you know, it makes so many millions of man hours of work a year, and the civil service recruits based on how much work it has to do every year. You saying I'm going to scrap 100,000 civil servants just means that they're 10% down on their staffing requirements for all the jobs you've got them to do anyway, which are legally required because it's a matter of government law. So what will actually happen is that you'll scrap 100,000 civil servants, what it is, and government services will just get worse, because instead of having 10 blokes in the team checkboxing meaningless paperwork before your planning application goes through, you've now only got two. But they still have to check the same boxes. It's the same amount of work. You've just got less people to do it. So what you have to do, Nigel, if you're listening, is actually propose legislation for bits you are getting rid of.
Well, to come back to Anglo-Futurism before we finish up here, old Tony and his institute just want to replace them all with AI.
Yeah.
They want to replace a huge chunk of the civil service and NHS management functions, just say, well, AI is going to do it.
Yeah, and in fact, I had an example of it only yesterday. I was looking up a piece of International Maritime Organization legislation. There's been changes, and I spent all morning reading the policy documentation, couldn't really make much sense of it. You know, it's all cross-referenced and all the rest of it. So I just bunged it into Google. Google, tell me about IMO resolution, blah, 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 blah. They went, yeah, here you go. Here's the salient points. Oh, it pertains to this piece. Oh, can you tell me more about that? Yeah, bing, done. 20 minutes, done. AI is the Hail Mary of the managerial state, because it is so unbelievably inefficient. It just hopes that AI can cut through it and make it all work. That's the only thing it's really being useful, and that's the only thing it's actually good at as well. I have to admit, you know, admittedly Google puts at the bottom of it brackets, this isn't legal advice, but it's a lot of policy and a lot of managerialism is just big spreadsheets that don't talk to each other. So you need a man to go in, spot the differences between the two and update them. And what AI does is it can instantly spot the differences and instantly update the spreadsheets. So it is the totalizing spreadsheet.
While we're on this topic, and before we finish up, now some people I know are convinced that we are going to get something approaching Mad Max world eventually, because they're saying, well, Britain can't possibly sustain the systems it has at the moment. And in, you know, when all the boomers retire, you know, when we have the new population, the competency crisis is going to hit a point where people just don't know how to maintain this stuff anymore. Things are going to fall apart. And all of these lovely visions that people like Blair have got or Anglo-Futurists have got, they can't possibly happen because, you know, we're going to collapse. What do you say to that as an engineer?
In the short term, they're completely correct. Unfortunately, there are too many issues baked into the system. And again, it comes back to you know, resource times competency equals effective output. There aren't enough people and they're not well supported enough to make this happen, you'll find a lot of systems, complicated systems. When they got rid of, when they tried to reduce the budgets, austerity was particularly bad for this.
Mm-hmm.
Was that how they reduced the costs was by scrapping maintenance routines and by extending the life of existing equipment. So now you've got a lot of stuff that was baked in, and this was baked in the 2010s,
mm-hmm.
where you got rid of the competent staff, you've life-exed the equipment, and during its life extension, you weren't maintaining it properly. So the capital costs alone of replacing a lot of this stuff is far beyond the capability of the country. So all that means is that some of it's going to have to fall over, and then it will take a while to bring it back. In the long term, you do sort of see the green shoots in the engineering. The engineering world is conscious of this, which is good. They also, this sort of demographic black hole that the engineering world has had, I think at one point it was something like 9% of engineers were between 50 and 30.
Mm-hmm.
But what that's done is put a break, that sort of clean break means that the engineers coming up now are doing things from a fresh perspective. That's actually quite good. It's sort of reanimating old systems, and it relieves you of the emotional baggage that you can actually just replace things with things that actually work. Mm-hmm. It's going to be rough. But in the next sort of 20 years, then you'll have 20 years of rebuilding. And then the 20 years after that, you'll see it quite well. It very much tracks the BR modernization plan, bringing it back to the railways, where BR was really, really bad in the 50s. It lost a lot of money. It was working on knackered old Victorian stock, which had been there longer than it should have been. It had this sort of destructive spasm in the 60s. It got a lot of things wrong, but it got a lot of things right. And then it was really into the 70s where it came out of the 60s as a completely different railway system, operating on a completely different philosophy. And it was into the 70s and into the corporate area that it really started to move forwards. And you'll see that in the country, I think, a lot for its better. And it will be, as we've been talking about, you know, the dysfunctional tax system and the dysfunctional building regulation system and the dysfunctional industrial standards system and things like that. The boomers are quite sentimentally attached to that. Millennials just see it as something that's been used to screw them over. So mm-hmm. when they get the opportunity, they will not be merciful, I don't think. And a lot of it will be ripped out.
One of the things I see everywhere that nobody ever really talks about is that doing stuff on the cheap leads to a kind of false economy.
Mm.
One that everybody will know about is where some massive contract is given to an Indian IT firm. They don't do a great job, so everything needs to be double checked or done again, basically. So you end up having to pay twice because you try to skimp up front. So then it had to be double checked. So you end up doing the job again. But I see this in all sorts of, like, really weird little example, right? I've got a neighbor who's in her late 90s, I think he's 99 years old. And obviously, at that point in life, she hasn't got a home, but she needs a lot of home help. Okay. So she has a nurse who's there. You know, she comes at 7 in the morning and leaves at 7 at night, something like that. Okay. The company who send the nurses send a different nurse every day. It's a different person.
Hmm.
Her, right, this is just a tiny example of it. Her door kind of doesn't open either. It's got like a funny thing to open. So every single day, the missus has to explain to a new nurse how to open that door. And I was like, well, why are they sending a different nurse every single day? Like, what's the reason for that? And the only thing I come up with is that this is being done on the cheap, and there's a central nurse agency somewhere who just for logistical reasons is allocating staff. But it means that no knowledge is built up. This is just literally a different person every single time. Surely, like, the ultimate reason though is cost, right? there's not like a dedicated member of staff, or I don't know, like these are the sorts of things I'm talking about. Seems like a false economy to me.
Yeah, I don't know if we're still conscious of time, but
yeah, we should wrap up in a minute. Yeah.
I was going to say, a lot of this I found is actually down to managerialism and individualism, and the virus of individualism, where it treats individuals as interchangeable. Because if you put a moral value onto even in your example, nurses, the same nurse turning up to the same lady every day, well, that value ends up sort of in contravention of the spirit of the Equality Act, mm-hmm. because everybody is interchangeable. So why would you want the same nurse every day? It must be racism or something like that. And you see it. We've had a similar thing in the NHS, where we've been customers of the NHS recently in the family, and I've got relations who work in the NHS as well, of course, as do we all, because it employs like one in seven people. But you sort of go through the NHS, and every single time you get to the next bit, it sounds like you're starting again.
Mm-hmm. And yes, then I've experienced it. Yeah.
Yeah, you go and see somebody, and then they say, right, I'm going to put you in this test. When you do this test, you have to ask for the results, and then you have to phone this number to go and talk to the next department. And then it's that sort of, unless you've actually got something like lupus or the Black Death or something like that, basically everything the NHS does is pretty routine. Mm-hmm. You know, every single thing, even, you know, weird cancers and things like that, it's all routine business. And it's always, you know, the same doctor talks to the same specialist about the same thing, and then you go to the same test, and then you, so it's like, why is there the legwork to put it back to the start every single time?
Mm.
You know, and why am I going back into the pool? And it is that sort of managerial individualism, where it's there's not that through thread anymore. But going back to the start means that, you know, even if it's 2 hours of administrative work on each patient every time you do that, well, that probably means there's been 12 or 15 hours of administrative work that didn't need to happen per patient. And there are millions and millions of patients. And yeah. And you see it a lot in the civil service, where they're totalizing belief in the system, because to believe in the individual ability and the individual character of each person in it is contrary to liberalism. If everybody's interchangeable, then you can treat everybody as interchangeable.
Mm.
But, and it's one of the things I've been wrestling with, actually, is, but that deracination actually proves Marx's alienation theory correct.
Mm.
So what you've, you know, you can't just declare somebody to be motivated. They have to be motivated, and they are motivated by being engaged in their work and seeing reward from the work. And if they're being treated as a typing pool every single day, they're never going to build that. And as you quite rightly say, they're never going to build the knowledge, which then means the institutional knowledge is never built up, which then means you're working from scratch every single time. And the amount of time that wastes is incalculable.
I mean, we've all been in the endless customer service loop as well, where you have to explain the same thing to eight different people. You know, I mean, I won't relive my nightmare with curries from a while back, you know. And then eventually you get through to the halcyon, like Donna from Derby, you know, you've spoken to eight different random Indians, right? But eventually you get through to the one person who's like an actual person who understands what you're saying, who actually just sorts the problem out. But it's like, well, why couldn't I speak to Donna first? Why did I have to explain the same thing to eight different people before I got to her? Yeah. It was just a waste of my time and a waste of their time. They have to pay all of those people have to be paid for their time as well. So it's anyway. Okay. So, Alex, where can people find you?
Find me on Twitter at @A2_masters, or just search Alex, that Steam guy. And you'll find me there.
And I'll just remind people, promo code Shorjan, 25% off all courses for all of January up until the 31st. Bye everyone. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.